Welcome back, everyone. It's Mary Strawn here, host of the Kids Who Color Outside the Lines interview series. I hope you're enjoying it so far. When I was going through looking for people to come on to speak with you, I realized that I was getting a lot of professionals, a lot of authors and coaches. And many of them are actually parents, too, and that's what makes it really great because they come from a place of having personal experience with a child who is complex or has, challenges at school or in life. But I also felt it would be really important to include a parent who could share with you, their perspective on raising a child who thinks outside the lines. So I've invited Julie Green to come on today, and I found her actually through a blog that she had written, and she can tell you a little bit more about that. But she's going to share today her perspective as a parent and some of the things that she's found has helped her as a parent as she raises her child. So, Julie Green, welcome to Kids Who Color Outside the Lines.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Great. Julie, let's get started by just telling listeners a little bit about yourself and your experience.
Sure. So my background, like a lot of moms out there or parents, I started a blog called Little Green One, which has been defunct for years. But it was mainly, I was living abroad at the time and I was pregnant and I was trying to keep in touch with friends and family here in Canada. And I started charting, all these sort of random things, funny things mostly about my pregnancy and all the way through to the birth of my first son. And I think I went till maybe around the age 2, and it was a very lighthearted blog initially until, I suffered from postpartum. It got a little heavier. My son had really intense colic. And looking back now, it was all very interesting because at age 3, he was diagnosed with autism. And it's really interesting for me to see the evolution of the blog and how, relative strangers found out about it, started reading and relating to it. And so really, I just kept writing about parenting. I kept writing about my experiences with my son as I went along through each stage with him and as I discovered things about him and things about, autism was absolutely not on my radar at all. And I was a first-time mom. So that just carried on. My little personal blog, as I say, is defunct, but I started working for Yummy Mummy Club and then HuffPost, and then I also just did a lot of freelance writing for magazines as well. But autism kind of took over and just getting to know and understand my son because it's constantly, he's amazing and he's just such a mystery to me. So I found that anything I could glean from the experience that would help other people, I was more than happy to share that. So as an extension of my early blogging days.
That's very cool. We can talk about that. Well, I want to ask you, does it help to have an outlet like that to be able to write about your experience? I know you want to do it in part to help other parents. But I was just wondering if you could tell us what it's like to actually, write publicly about your journey, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like when I started, it was, as I say, it was quite humorous and it was meant for family and friends. And then a strange thing happens when you find out that complete strangers are reading it and finding it helpful. But at the time you're sitting down, it's very much just like a diary. You're journaling like when you were a young kid and you're just trying to figure things out. And I often, obviously, I have that awareness that I'm hitting post these days, and I know it
right.
still doesn't seem totally real in my mind that lots of people might be reading this that I don't know. I try to not really think about that. To be honest, I still sit down every time and, with the main purpose of just trying to figure it out myself and hoping that obviously if other people are out there trying to figure it out and it resonates, then
mm-hmm.
great. But it has occurred to me a few times when I'm writing about more difficult or more painful things or things that are harder to admit. To be honest, now it's the opposite. I'm more concerned about my mother reading sometimes or then sometimes in a way it's easier for total strangers to be reading it than people closest
yeah.
to you when
okay.
it gets a little bit more painful.
Yes.
But I think it's really important to share. Parenting is so complex and it's so murky and it's just a big, it's a balance, it's awful and it's awesome. And even
mm-hmm.
one day in the life can be a bit of everything. So
at the time
there wasn't so much emphasis on the positives of autism. It was, autism is such a tragedy and we're trying to cure autism. And there was such a negative slant that I tried in my own way to, not totally celebrate it, that might be the wrong term, but to bring some lightheartedness to it and to celebrate some of the fun or interesting things that my son does, or, I think it's inseparable from who he is. And
yeah.
He's an amazing kid. So I wanted to shed a bit more light on that aspect.
Well, thank you for doing that part.
Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Okay, let's start into what you'd like to share today. I don't even know words. I don't want to say words of wisdom, but what's helped you as you go through this journey, the process of raising a child? What are some things you'd like to share?
Yeah, like you say, I'm absolutely no expert. It's been 4 years now, so I like to think maybe I've learned a few things the hard way or along the way. I'm still figuring it out as each day goes along. So I don't think you ever come to a point with a child who's so unique where you think, yeah, I've got this. I've totally nailed it. But a few things I have learned that have really been helpful with him. The first
mm-hmm.
one was, this doesn't apply to all kids, but more specifically maybe to kids with autism, maybe kids with ADHD as well. Like when my son is into something, his interests are
mm-hmm.
very much not even borderline obsessions. They are full on. Nothing else exists in the world.
Yes.
And I've heard the interests can range from like really unorthodox and really kind of weird things, like kids who are interested in vacuum cleaners and know every single model since the vacuum cleaner, was
yes.
invented. Luckily,
right.
in my son's case, it wasn't vacuum cleaners, but his very early interest, probably even before age two, was alphabet. And obviously all the, preschooler toys are aimed at phonics. But my son never really let go of that. So it turned into him learning the alphabet in several different languages, but it was just fixating on the letters themselves. He'd make them out of Play-Doh. We have jars of literally letters made out of wood, letters made, the magnet letters, every material known to man, and he'd hold them and carry them, and they were like animate objects for him. They were like friends, or the way kids would treat dolls.
Mm-hmm.
So like anything, but he was playing, there were no other interests in his life. He wouldn't play with other toys in any conventional way. So half the time I was, spending all this energy trying to get him to be interested in other things. Why won't you play
right.
Lego? Why won't you play Hot Wheels? Why won't you just do whatever other kids are doing? And then I finally got to the point where, if I want to connect with him and really have a deeper bond with him, I have to actually get on get on his level in some way, and that was the vehicle to do it, even though it drove, you know, this letter obsession drove us crazy, my husband and I. But if you can't beat him, join him. That was my approach in the end. And I would use the letters as a means to engage with him. So we would hide, we'd play hide and seek with the letters. I'd make the alphabet and make a matching game, or I had to really get creative. But ultimately, because that was such a strong passion for him, kind of tapping into his world and his passion was the best way to connect with him, I found. And it actually brought us closer. And so all this energy I was expending trying to subtly shift or change his interest was just pointless, and it was frustrating. So I found that was the best way to connect with him and bridge the gap a little bit and get into his world. And it was also sort of teasing him out a little and playing games with him through that interest. So, and then, you know, ultimately I'm glad it wasn't vacuum cleaners. And I am also glad to say his interest has finally shifted. He's now 7. And his new obsession is Shopkins, which are these very little girly, they're kind of very marketed to girls.
We have a few.
But you have a few. So I am really relieved after 7 years of letters to see the shift. He still loves letters, but he knows everything there is to know about Shopkins. So again, I'm so do I. You know, so I'm learning not to fight it, just to go with where he's at and make the connection there, instead of wishing away, you know, wishing that he was another child. So he's not another child, he's himself. So that's one piece of advice for sure, or something I've learned anyway that's really helped bring us closer.
That's wonderful. What do you think, you know, when you were resisting that a little bit, can you put a word or a, you know, can you put anything to that resistance? Was it?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if I was still in the process of accepting him and accepting, it's not just a label, but just accepting that he's a quirky kid. He is a kid who colors outside the lines. And I think, to some extent, parents, we all have this idea of, you know, well, I want my daughter to do ballet because maybe I didn't get to do ballet. Or we have these visions of what we want our children to be, and letting go of that for any child, typical or not, is there's a lot of resistance. Every now and then I still find myself kind of clutching onto, you know, I wish he was into this, or I wish he was doing that. And it's not just accepting it in this resigned way, but actually getting to know who your kid actually is and who they want to be, and not just accepting it in this horrible resigned way, but thinking they're cool and sharing their passion, because it's nice to see how enthusiastic he is about something.
Did you ever think that he would change from the alphabet?
Well, I was hoping.
I know you're hoping.
I had heard that these, like, fixations go in phases, and they can last, I don't know, some people had told me through 4 years. There's no, like, definite answer where suddenly a switch is flicked. But I was sort of hopeful that it would eventually run its course, if only because I was running out of ideas. And he was never bored of it, but we were, you know, we were just kind of running out of ideas and running out of steam with it, and finding ways to, we don't want to pretend we're interested in it. We want to be genuine and authentic people, but at the same point, it does wear on you, because you're human, and the same thing day in, day out for years on end is, it's tricky when you don't share that kind of obsession.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's something else that you'd like to share with listeners?
So the second piece I thought about was advocacy. And I know it's been talked about to death. And I think it probably has a bad rep in a way, because we picture, I think we liken advocacy to almost, not harassment, but kind of being nasty, being assertive to a flaw, to a fault. And I don't think it has to be that way. The way I view advocacy is mostly kind of doing detective work on your kid's behalf and finding out what the right fit is for your child, be it the right therapy, the right after-school activity, the right school. I think it's so important, especially while kids are young, to find the right fit for your kid, especially with regard to education, because my son has been to 4 schools in 4 years, and it sounds horrible, but it was something I just had to do to find the right fit for him. And it was a lot of trial and error. But, you know, kids don't have time to waste floundering in the wrong place for years. I met lots of kind teachers, lots of kind principals, had really good relationships with everyone. And that's not to say it was the right fit for my son. So,
yes.
And so it's not necessarily the most expensive option or the most popular option or whatever. It's just a case of finding out what actually will serve your child best and not stopping until you find that, because it can make such a huge difference to the way they develop, their confidence. Everything suffers, I think, when your kid is not in the right place or getting the right kind of support. And unfortunately for us, it just took a long time. It took 4 schools.
Right.
well-meaning placements, totally different placements. We went through the special needs system. We went through the public system, mainstream, different variations of private and independent schools. And, you know, I think like some parents, I came at it from the approach of thinking, oh, well, you know, private schools are so elitist, and I thought, no, there's no way, you know, my child, and my back was up as well, thinking, well, you know, I don't really want my son to be in special education. He's pretty high functioning, and
right.
You come at it with all these, your own prejudgments, but ultimately, yeah, I had to just find what was working for my son, and who could best support him so that he wasn't stagnating. His development wasn't stagnating. So that's the way I tend to look at advocacy. I don't think, obviously sometimes you have to take a firm approach, but I don't think that advocacy necessarily has to be, doesn't need to make you an evil, argumentative person. It's just literally a case of detective work and finding the right fit, and because our kids need that. They can't afford to lose years in the wrong place. So that's...
This is something that we haven't talked about so far on this series, is making the decision to move a child from, you know, the school that they're, you know, meant to be at, you know, based on where they live and, you know, what your... you know, if they're going to a Catholic school or a, you know, a regular school. We haven't really touched on the making the decision to move them. So I'm glad that you've raised this. Mm-hmm. How did you know, I don't want you to, like, you know, but just how did you know that it wasn't the right fit for your son, without going into the details of the school per se, but how did
You know, I think kids are so individual, and there are just so many boxes to tick. And in this case, the school was great. Teachers were great. I even sat down and had a chat with his teacher at the time to explain to her that I think academically she knew my son's a really mixed bag. He's got some very challenging behaviors. On one hand, but he also is, I guess, borderline gifted. I don't know. Probably gifted, if you want to give it that label as well. So he absolutely wasn't being challenged to, you know, performing at grade level. He wasn't doing anything academic, and I was happy to let that ride for a little while, but I didn't want years to go by of him not being challenged or stimulated academically, because I knew that could also, you know, it could hinder him in other ways. It was probably hurting his self-esteem. It was making him bored and not maybe even, you know, furthering some behaviors out of the boredom. So, again, more detective work and finding a couple different schools that I just, a lot of this stuff comes on the grapevine, unfortunately. I've passed things on to other parents. And again, totally, you know, this school we're happy with right now may totally not be the fit from the other parents I've spoken to, but I'm happy to,
yeah, of course,
to obviously pass, you know, pass it on. And if it fits, great. If not, keep trying. There are good independent schools out there. Unfortunately, I wish there were there were more choices than there are. And you know, I think in some cases the public system is fantastic for kids. I know people who are having a great experience and aren't having to fight for accommodations for their children. And I know other cases where, in my son's case, it absolutely was not the right fit. And a special needs class, it was fine. But again, he's, you know, what works for some kids absolutely won't work for others. So it is very individual.
So I think what I'm hearing you say is every child is different, obviously. So it's not about that. It's more about knowing what you perhaps want your child to achieve in the academic setting, and also looking at if they're able to support them to get to that place. But I'm also, you know, hearing the behavior part too. You know, it sounds like he was bored at one point too, and it was probably contributing to some of the behavior that they were seeing. So I just want to, you know, put that out there for parents. Sometimes we have to make tough choices, and we have to be a detective, like Julie says, and say, is this, you know, where they are right now, is this the best fit for where we want to see? And so it's some detective work, and it's also some thinking about where we see our kids and how we see them as a learner and what we want them to be achieving. Does that sound pretty accurate in your mind?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Okay. All right. So let's move on to your last point.
Well, my last point is probably the hardest. it's about patience and empathy. And, you know, the irony is, especially with autism, they say, you know, autistic people just, they can't put themselves in other people's shoes, and they don't have empathy, which is ridiculous, because so many of us have difficulty trying to put ourselves in their shoes and to imagine what they're, we only can try to imagine what they're going through. But a lot of times when there are behaviors for, you know, a lot of kids, ADHD, autism, you name it, kids who do tend to have behaviors, who we interpret their behaviors as being impulsive or malicious or, I know in my son's case, he just doesn't have the wherewithal to even do that. I think often he knows, and I feel like he's pressing my buttons. He's really trying to upset me. He's deliberately misbehaving. But I absolutely think in most cases, kids would if they could, and if he just does not have the tools. And we don't try to look at the big picture. Again, it's about playing detective and thinking, well, you know, and matching our own expectations. Because, for instance, there was a time I went on holiday with my son. We were so geared up, and we were on the beach. It was a beautiful day, and yes, let's build a sandcastle. My son loves sand, right? He loves playing in the sand. But we hadn't done a sandcastle at that point or whatever, so we got some water. Suddenly, when the sand became wet and touched his body, he started screaming and sort of tearing at himself. He was just so upset, and immediately I started crying because there were my visions of this idyllic family holiday. But to him, sensory or otherwise, to him it was hell. So he was upset because he was really uncomfortable. He didn't know how to express it, and that's how it manifested. And I think a lot of times we think this is such willful misbehavior, when in fact, I think my son is just not at a place right now where he has the tools to control certain outbursts and certain impulses that he has. So it's not that he's not trying hard enough or that he's out to annoy me. For instance, he has this thing he does at home, kind of drives us crazy, but I always have to stop myself and think. He'll walk by, and if the margarine dish or butter dish is open, he'll stick his finger in it and he'll run away laughing. And every time we've told him, and it's so mischievous, but I honestly think even though we've told him 500 times, to some extent, he sometimes does things. He doesn't have that gap to think, should I be doing this? And he just has that impulse sometimes that he, for whatever reason, has to fill. I'm not excusing behaviors because I still, my son still gets corrected and we still work on things with him. But I think, I really think a lot of times it's not willful, and we have to try harder to see things through their perspective. Is that situation, is it too crowded? Is that noise really upsetting them and causing this outburst that comes later? We have to try to piece a picture together, because I do think kids ultimately do want to please their parents. They don't want to disappoint their parents, and a lot of time they're upset in their own skin anyway, and I think they could use more understanding, more patience.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you do to help remind yourself that?
I think over the years, just learning more about autism and sort of sensory issues has helped.
Yeah. So educating yourself.
So giving my son, and I mean over time as well, my son's desensitized a lot to various things. But just taking a slower approach, he's terrified of water, and water touching his face in particular. So it's just being sensitive to that, and working with him. For instance, if he's in the shower, we got him some big goggles he can wear. We don't push him maybe so hard. We try to be a little more patient and understanding, especially for sensory issues, now that we understand how physically painful it is. I have kind of sensory issues myself about sound and crowds. So I think naturally I was always a bit more empathetic to him for that, because I could kind of see it and have that awareness. But I feel like when it comes to behavior, the knee-jerk reaction for a parent is, I'm going to dig my heels in even more because you're pressing my buttons, and it feels like it just makes you want to lay down the authority more. So it's really, really, as I said, that's why this is the most difficult piece that I work on every single day, to try to remind myself that in 9 times out of 10, the behavior isn't willful. It's because he's struggling with something he can't quite control yet. And just encourage, he just needs, just giving kids a lot of encouragement to use their words, however, to get them through that phase, which just takes time, I think, and a lot of support, instead of the approach of, you're in big trouble and you need a timeout. And I think it's that there can be a kinder way to support children without really firm discipline, because often that approach backfires anyway and causes really, wilder behaviors than
yes
than not
than what started out with.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
and again,
I'm not a psychologist.
I'm just a parent.
No, but that's why
that's
I wanted you to join us, because I think it's one thing to hear, you know, from based on, you know, research and studies and to give the other guests credit. I mean, they are doing a lot of work, but I wanted to hear, you know, you live this every day, so. Mm-hmm. Your perspective is equally as valuable to everyone listening. So thank you for sharing that with us. Yeah, and it's lived experience, right? That's different. Lived experience counts and is so important in this conversation.
Absolutely.
I wanted to, you know, what's really stood out for me today is how you've described playing detective, or being a detective when it comes to our kids, because, you know, if we can do that, you know, there's all kinds of clues and all kinds of information. And I think when we have those clues and when we have that information, we can start to, like you say, have more patience, have more empathy. We can start to connect with our kids in ways that are meaningful to them. And we can also get them the support that they need outside of the family as well. So, Julie, I want to say a really big thank you for your time and your willingness to share and be open with us today. I very much appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Now, you have a Facebook page, and I'm going to let you share that with listeners. No, go ahead. You share it, and then I'll tell you. Well, maybe you can tell people why about the blogs, too.
Sure. So I have a Facebook page, which is called Spectrum Parenting, and it's essentially a resource for parents who have kids on the spectrum, the autism spectrum. So there I share a lot of outside resources and a lot of blogs and articles and things I've written myself, but also just interesting bits and pieces I find all over the place, you know, to help foster a sense of community, I guess, and also sometimes just asking other people questions, you know, what's working for you, what are you struggling with right now, mm-hmm. hoping to just make that a good information hub.
Okay. And you mentioned that you write for Yummy Mummy Club and the Huffington Post. So you actually you post that on your Facebook page as well.
I do.
If people were interested in reading your blogs, go to your Facebook page. Is that correct?
Yes, they can. Yes, they can. I have sort of a history of publications on my website as well, which is just juliemgreen.ca. But that's just got a history of like a long list of publications. But generally, as things come up, I do share a whole bunch of things, my own and other people's, on, you know, via the Facebook page.
Perfect. Yeah, no, I think it's important people know how to learn more about you, and it may be helpful for them to read those blogs and connect with you on that community. So thank you for that. It's great. All right. We're going to wrap up with Julie now, but I want to encourage you to please check your email tomorrow, because you're going to get to find out who the next guest is. And I'm looking forward to you being able to explore some more perspectives from our other guests as the month goes on. So thanks for joining me, Julie.
pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for taking time out of your day to tune in as well. So we'll talk to you soon.